It is Saturday, market day. Lucy wakes him at 5 as arranged with coffee. Swaddled against the cold, they join Petrus in the garden, where by the light of a halogen lamp he's already cutting flowers. He offers to take over from Petrus, but his fingers are soon so cold that he cannot tie the bunches. He passes the twine back to Petrus and instead wraps and packs. By 7, with dawn touching the hills and the dogs beginning to stir, the job is done. The combi is loaded with boxes of flowers, pockets of potatoes, onions, cabbage. Lucy drives, Petrus stays behind. The heater does not work. Peering through the misted windscreen, she takes the Grahamstown road. He sits beside her, eating the sandwiches she has made. His nose drips. He hopes she does not notice. So, a new adventure. His daughter, whom he once upon a time used to drive to school and ballet class, to the circus and the skating rink, is taking him on an outing, showing him life, showing him this other unfamiliar world. On Donkin Square, stallholders are already setting up trestle tables and laying out their wares. There is a smell of burning meat. A cold mist hangs over the town. People rub their hands, stamp their feet, curse. There is a show of bonhomie from which Lucy, to his relief, holds herself apart. They are in what appears to be the produce quarter. On their left are 3 African women with milk, masa, butter to sell. Also, from a bucket with a wet cloth over it, soup bones. On their right are an old Afrikaner couple whom Lucy greets as Tante Mims and Oom Koos, and little assistant in a balaclava cap who cannot be more than 10. Like Lucy, they have potatoes and onions to sell, but also bottled jams, preserves, dried fruit, packets of buchu tea, honeybush tea, herbs. Lucy has brought 2 canvas stools. They drink coffee from a thermos flask, waiting for the first customers. 2 weeks ago, he was in a classroom explaining to the bored youth of the country the distinction between drink and drink up, burned and burnt. The perfective, signifying an action carried through to its conclusion. How far away it all seems. I live, I have lived, I lived. Lucy's potatoes, tumbled out into a bushel basket, have been washed clean. Koos and Mims's are still speckled with earth. In the course of the morning, Lucy takes in nearly 500 rand. Her flowers sell steadily. At 11 o'clock, she drops her prices and the last of the produce goes. There is plenty of trade, too, at the milk and meat stall, but the old couple seated side by side, wooden and unsmiling, do less well. Many of Lucy's customers know her by name, middle-aged women, most of them, with a touch of the proprietary in their attitude to her, as though her success were theirs, too. Each time she introduces him, "Meet my father, David Lurie, on a visit from Cape Town." "You must be very proud of your daughter, Mr. Lurie," they say. "Yes, very proud," he replies. "Bev runs the animal refuge," says Lucy after one of the introductions. "I give her a hand sometimes. We'll drop in at her place on the way back, if that's all right with you." He has not taken to Bev Shaw, a dumpy, bustling little woman with black freckles, close-cropped, wiry hair, and no neck. He does not like women who make no effort to be attractive. It is a resistance he has had to Lucy's friends before. Nothing to be proud of, a prejudice that has settled in his mind, settled down. His mind has become a refuge for old thoughts, idle, indigent, with nowhere else to go. He ought to chase them out, sweep the premises clean. But he does not care to do so, or does not care enough. The sign outside the clinic reads, Animal Welfare League W01529. At the door is a line of waiting people, some with animals. As soon as he gets out of his car, there are children all around him, begging for money or just staring. He makes his way through the crush, and through a sudden cacophony as two dogs, held back by their owners, snarl and snap at each other. In the inner room, which smells pungently of urine, Bev Shaw is working at a low, steel-topped table. With a pencil light, she is peering down the throat of a young dog that looks like a cross between a ridgeback and a jackal. Kneeling on the table, a barefoot child, evidently the owner, has the dog's head clamped under his arm and is trying to hold its jaws open. A low, gurgling snarl comes from its throat. Awkwardly, he joins in the tussle, pressing the dog's hind legs together, forcing it to sit on its haunches. Thank you, says Bev Shaw. Her face is flushed. There's an abscess here from an impacted tooth. We have no antibiotics, so... Hold him still, Boyke, so we just have to lancet and hope for the best. She probes inside the mouth with a lancet. The dog gives a tremendous jerk, breaks free of him, almost breaks free of the boy. He grasps it as it scrabbles to get off the table. For a moment, its eyes full of rage and fear glare into his. On his side, so, says Bev Shaw. Making crooning noises, she expertly trips up the dog and turns it on its side. The belt, she says. He passes a belt around its body and she buckles it. So, says Bev Shaw, think comforting thoughts, think strong thoughts. They can smell what you are thinking. He leans his full weight on the dog. They can smell what you are thinking. What nonsense. There, there, he murmurs. Bev Shaw probes again with the lancet. The dog gags, goes rigid, then relaxes. So, she says, now we must let nature take its course. She unbuckles the belt, speaks to the child in what sounds like very halting Xhosa. The child coaxes the dog out. Thank you, Mr. Lurie. You have a good presence. I sense that you like animals. Do I like animals? I eat them, so I suppose I must like them, some parts of them. Her hair is a mass of little curls. Does she make the curls herself with tongs? Unlikely. It would take hours every day. They must grow that way. He's never seen such a tessitura from close by. She is pondering his words, whose tone she happens to have missed. Yes, we eat up a lot of animals in this country, she says. It doesn't seem to do us much good. I'm not sure how we will justify to them. Then, shall we start on the next one? He spends all afternoon in the surgery, helping as far as he is able. When the last of the day's cases has been dealt with, Bev Shaw shows him around the yard. In the avian cage, there is only one bird, a young fish eagle with a splintered wing. For the rest, there are dogs. Not Lucy's well-groomed thoroughbreds, but a mob of scrawny mongrels filling two pens to bursting point, barking, yapping, whining, leaping with excitement. He's watching the dogs eat. It surprises him how little fighting there is. The small, the weak, hold back, accepting their lot, waiting their turn. The trouble is, there are just too many of them, says Bev Shaw. They don't understand it, of course, and we have no way of telling them. Too many by our standards, not by theirs. One of the dogs, replete, eyes shining with well-being, sniffs his fingers through the mesh, licks them. They are very egalitarian, aren't they, he remarks. No classes, no one too high and mighty to smell another's backside. He squats, allows the dog to smell his face, his breath. It has what he thinks of as an intelligent look, though it is probably nothing of the kind. Are they all going to die? Those that no one wants, we'll put them down. And you are the one who does the job. Yeah. You don't mind? I do mind. I mind deeply. I wouldn't want someone doing it for me who didn't mind. Would you? He is silent. Then, do you know why my daughter sent me to you? She told me you were in trouble. Not just in trouble, in what I suppose one would call disgrace. He watches her closely. She seems uncomfortable, but perhaps he is imagining it. Knowing that, do you still have a use for me? He says. If you are prepared, she opens her hands, presses them together, opens them again. She does not know what to say, and he does not help her.